Nick Gillespie with Reason TV. This is the Reason TV talk show, a freewheeling discussion of politics, culture, and ideas. My co-host is Michael C. Moynihan. And our guests today are Pete Leeson, an economist at George Mason University and the author of the new book, The Invisible Hook, The Hidden Economics of Pirates, and David Post of Temple University and the author of the new book, Jefferson's Moose, Notes on the State of Cyberspace. Pete, tell us very quickly, what's the hook of The Invisible Hook?
Well, the basic idea of it is that pirates, like everyone else, were economic actors. So they were self-interested, they were profit-motivated, and in fact, in the book, what I kind of look at is analyzing a pirate crew as a firm, if you will. Pirates were also rational. They applied the most appropriate means that they could find to try and pursue their profit-motivated ends. And they responded rationally to incentives then. When the cost of activities went up, you know, they engaged in fewer of those activities.
You argue, in fact, that pirates were restrained by the profit motive rather than set loose in wild ways. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, you know, one thing that you can actually see, actually an analog in modern-day pirates, is that, you know, and this is also true for 18th-century pirates, but they made their living by, you know, extracting revenue from people, from stealing from them. So one of the things that you want to do is not anger those people to the greatest extent possible. You want to get them to cooperate with you, which means not killing them arbitrarily, not brutalizing them arbitrarily, and in general, generating kind of a felicitous relationship with them when you can, simply because it cuts down on your cost of extracting loot.
I'm sorry, are you talking about pirates or the federal government? No, I've lost track somewhere. David, Jefferson's Moose,
yes.
What is the state of cyberspace, and then what's the meaning of the controlling metaphor of your book, Jefferson's Moose?
The idea of the book was to rewrite Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia for cyberspace, to sort of go through his kind of research project.
And you leave out, thankfully, all of the racial
stuff that's not useful to me. I leave out a lot of stuff.
The racial stuff apparently is very useful to him.
It's only about race.
There's a good deal of the Jefferson canon that is not terribly useful. Right. I'm trying to extract what is. The moose as a metaphor turns out to be really actually quite interesting. It was the moose that Jefferson had shipped to him in Paris and reassembled. I mean, sort of one of the questions, one of the themes of the book is sort of what was he up to? To understand what he was doing in Notes on Virginia, I think you really have to understand the moose was kind of part of this dialogue that he was having with the scientists of the world about scale and size. And there are some important things
because the moose was essentially unknown to
and it was unknown. I mean, it was both huge. And Jefferson had this, it's almost an obsession with huge animals. And I think that actually means something to him and his thought. And it was new. So it was a way of sort of dazzling them and having them stand back and say, it's a new world over there. You know, it has things in it we have not seen.
And the idea at the time, especially amongst the French, there's a terrific book by a guy named Philippe Roger, a French academic, who wrote about this idea at the time that the French had argued that American animals were smaller, weaker.
Exactly.
Is that part of the motivation?
Well, totally. That was the motivation, really. This was a decade-long debate for Jefferson. Much of Notes on Virginia is about that there, the theory that animals actually degenerated in the New World. And while it's sort of silly and ridiculous in retrospect, I mean, animals. They had no idea why.
The U.S. is the greatest country.
Exactly. Well, it does, you know.
Salute the camera when you say that.
Yeah, it was in fact, it was an important scientific debate, if nothing else. In fact, it helped develop things that led to Darwinism, the study of size and scale among animals. So while it was sort of odd, what's odd about it is how seriously Jefferson took it. I mean, in a sense, why he cared so much about whether the European scientists thought that animals got smaller in the New World, I think is part of the mystery of Jefferson, in a sense.
Pete, one of the things that you talk about in your book is how pirate ships, rather than being these kinds of mass scenes of anarchy and just no laws whatsoever, no rules, each boat had a constitution or a charter or a code that was actually written down and agreed to?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think it's actually right to characterize pirate ships as anarchic, freewheeling environments. And they were certainly anarchic in the sense that there was no, you know, official, formal, coercive element there. But on the other hand, that anarchy didn't translate into chaos, and that's precisely because of this system of constitutional democracy that they had sort of adopted. And one of the things that's remarkable to me is that they adopted this system as early as they did. They did it, of course, you know, before the United States had adopted anything like this. And in fact, in some ways, their system of constitutional democracy predated the English Bill of Rights, which is was just unimaginable to me beforehand.
That's a left-handed compliment in a way. I mean, one might... I can imagine some
to
of our...
To pirates or to the...
Well, to the U.S., yeah. to the system right. of constitutional government, in right. a sense. I mean, I can imagine somebody watching this saying, well, they were... Goodness, the pirates were the first to come up with the it's not a strong recommendation, I guess.
Well, I think it's a really strong recommendation, you know, for a couple of reasons. One is, just to go back for a second, of course they weren't the first to come up with you know, either constitutions or democracy, right. but they were
but
early harbingers
sure.
of it, yeah. But one of the things that I think helps, you know, does recommend it is you know, the fact that this system worked so well among incredible, terrible rogues.
Right.
And the effectiveness in that sense, which points to the robustness of, when implemented correctly, democratic and constitutional checks, which have, in the case of pirates, and I think this is one of the critical things, had unanimous support in the background. It wasn't like one of these fake social contracts that, you know, I think we have today, you know, in America, where we didn't actually sign on to any, you know, social agreement, and so that causes things to look a lot differently. On pirate ships, they actually were genuine social contracts.
So it's, your argument is essentially even pirates create and enforce social contracts when they make sense.
Exactly. When in fact it's in their interest.
What happens though, because the pirate ship, I mean, if you focus on the pirate ship, but then you kind of ignore the fact that one of their whole reason for being was to exploit
right.
other people,
sure.
then are we back to a kind of Leninist critique of capitalism where, you know, the rich people can all get together and create a very nice place and a stable place for themselves at the cost of the developing world or the third world or the people that they're exploiting?
Well, some pirate historians try, I guess, sort of building on a related theme, try and say pirates are reacting to a world in which that normally takes place, which is one of the mm-hmm. reasons they want to hold them up, that they're kind of revolting against this early mercantilist, you know, capitalist system, and they're getting back what's rightfully theirs. I think that's entirely wrong. You know, the reason that pirates, from as far as I can gather from the historical record, the reason that pirates enter piracy is simply because the payoff is higher than it is in legitimate employment. If they could have earned more as legitimate sailors, they would have. And we see, in fact, over time, as the costs of being a pirate rise and the benefit of legitimate alternative employments rise, that pirates move out of illegitimate employment and into legitimate employment. So they seem to be just basic economic actors.
It's interesting. I mean, Jefferson... The pairing is interesting of Jefferson and the pirates. One of the important things he did in Europe was to try to stamp out the pirates,
right.
the Barbary
yeah.
pirates.
Barbary
that was, and it was one of the first examples, I guess. I'm not really a historian, but one of the early examples of international cooperation to do something. And he was traveling around Europe right. trying to get people to sign on with some success in the battle against the Barbary pirates on the shores of Tripoli and all that.
Right.
And yet, your argument, in a sense, is that here's this sort of social contractarian little, I don't want to overstate your argument, but little
I do. It's okay.
paradise of self-government. And Jefferson, of course, the apostle of self-government, is organizing everybody to stamp them out. It is ironic, if nothing else.
It is, but it's a little bit different because the Barbary pirates come when Jefferson is going against them, right? Is later. I'm talking about early 18th century.
Okay.
And also, Barbary pirates are not true pirates in the sense that they had state backing.
They did.
And the guys that I'm looking at, you know, were declared enemies of the whole world. You know?
Yeah. I mean, these are not the privateers that were underwritten by various European governments or other states, but rather these were true men without flags. I mean, men without nations,
yeah.
in any case.
Yeah.
Exactly. How does this relate to, I mean, obviously pirates have been in the news quite a bit recently, and mostly in Somalia, right? And sort of 100% of these people seem to come from Somalia. How do you view that through, I mean, you're obviously looking at something from the 17th century, 18th
Late
century.
17th, early 18th, yeah.
Are there any parallels, or is this just something, like this sort of piracy is just sort of flat out stealing? I mean, there's no sort of social contracts. Is there any relation between these two?
There is. I mean, they're both flat out stealing, and you see some similarities, which is, as again, the Somali pirates are also just economic actors. It's a profit motivated activity, even though they've done some their best with some PR to try and make it sound like...
Now, is it different as far as...
If Somalia had a minimum wage...
I'd be living there if they did. But, I mean, these are huge numbers. I mean, they're demanding $5, $10 million a pop. I mean, there's a difference of scale, too, isn't there?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's a little bit hard to say because, you know, some early 18th century pirates could earn enough in a single, you know, successful plundering expedition to count for, you know, something like half a century's worth of legitimate wages. Mm-hmm. So we have to do a whole bunch of adjustments to do, you know, comparisons with the modern day. But mm-hmm. it's certainly the case that early 18th mm-hmm. century pirates were also able to take incredible hauls. Mm-hmm. I actually think that some of the hauls of modern pirates have been overstated a little bit. People keep talking about the Somali pirates are millionaires. No, they're not. I mean, take a look at what's happening in Somalia. You don't see guys rolling around in Ferraris living in mansions. Mm-hmm. These people are you know, exceedingly poor.
Although they can extract a different, back to the sort of the parallel, they can extract a different kind of payment. They're not just after for the plunder or the goods.
Yeah. They ransom.
They ransom.
Exactly.
Which you couldn't, just the technology mm-hmm. means mm-hmm. nowadays, you can do that in
That's
a way
true.
That you couldn't, I guess,
did
in
1780. Pirates actually say, shiver my timbers?
It's interesting that, yes, so from what I can gather, nothing in the historical record has anything about shivering like timbers. Mm-hmm. But there has been this interesting kind of online debate that I've followed, which some historians have engaged in, about whether or not pirates said things like "arg" and so on.
Parrots
is true.
Yeah.
Pirates did have exotic birds on their ships, so there's historical foundation for that. But the language thing, there's some discussion, since a lot of pirates are coming from England, and in particular certain parts of England, whether or not the types of things that we attribute to pirates were, you know, consistent with the dialect. Right. Yeah. So the short answer is probably
pro pirate. Do people accuse you of being pro pirate?
You're objectively
pro pirate.
In the book, I say we should all be unabashedly pro pirate.
Yeah. Okay. So you you're very clear about your pro pirate bias.
How did you get into pirates?
I mean, you know, I got into
when
pirates.
When did you know you were a pirate?
When did you first realize
you
that you were a pirate?
Strange stirrings during adolescence.
Exactly.
When you're watching Huck.
Not fitting in.
Actually, I kind of did. Pirates of the Caribbean at Disney World was my first, fascination with pirates began then, and then obviously my academic interest, began when I was 2 years later,
like
when I was 11.
All academics, it stems directly from a Disney World ride.
Right, that's a good foundation for all work.
You were a teacup man, right?
Talk
about, you know, one thing, thinking about piracy, and cyberspace is a hotbed of piracy, and yet in your book you talk about how that, you know, and that has framed the debate, that cyberspace is a kind of pirate haven where people go, including one of the biggest file sharing sites in Scandinavia,
Pirate Bay.
That people go there so that they can just loot legitimate kind of bricks and mortar businesses. But you say that's actually not the story of cyberspace.
Well, I think, although that has gotten all the headlines, the story of cyberspace is that there have been fewer conflicts, I think, than mm-hmm. one might have imagined. If you were to dump all of the world's people into a single place, you'd think there would be nothing but sort of plunder and pillage and whatever. And in fact, you know, most of the space is actually relatively lawful, mm-hmm. Or at least people behave in a way they conform to each other's expectations about behavior. There are pirates. This is an example, I think, of sort of smuggling. You know, goods are smuggled across mm-hmm. the border into cyberspace, and then they are traded according to the rules of sort of the cyberspace world and not necessarily the rules here.
But then you also stress that is not qualitatively different than goods being smuggled into countries, say, that don't abide by copyright protection.
Correct.
And then,
right. And one of the parallels, I mean, the United States for a long time was that kind of copyright pirate. I mean, we did not protect foreign works. You would smuggle works in from England. You wouldn't even have to smuggle them. You could bring them across the border from England, reprint them, copyright.
Which is one of the reasons why many of the best-known 19th-century American writers actually published their books in England first, to obtain copyright protection in England.
Right, and they were angry, and they're the ones who sort of started a movement in the United States to actually recognize international copyright that was relatively successful. So it's perfectly predictable that you would be trying to grab music files or whatever and send them around. That's not to say it's the rightness or the wrongness of it, I think, is a separate question.
Well,
one
of the notes that you hit in your book is that actually cyberspace, for as a kind of generic term, actually has relatively, that's a creative space, not because it has too little, or rather not because of so little intellectual property rights, but actually because it minimizes intellectual
property. Well, that's right. Now, you would have expected, I mean, one of the nice things about working on Jefferson, in a sense, mm-hmm. or taking a historical perspective, is that it also makes you do things like, suppose we're in 1980, and in 1980, if someone were to say, you know, we're going to set up this network, and we're basically not going to have any intellectual property protections as a practical matter on it, most intelligent people, myself included, probably would have said, well, you're not going to have much content on that. I mean, that's sort of part of our theory, is that without the protections, you don't get content.
Right. And this is in the Constitution of the United States, that the reason you have intellectual property rights is to invest, to give people an incentive.
Exactly. To create. Produce, yeah. Exactly. So that if we don't have intellectual property protections here, it'll be sort of a barren wasteland. Right. And in fact, that has not happened. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say sort of the opposite has happened in a way. It's been this explosion of creative effort. So something we don't understand about
that. How does that factor into other types of intellectual property debates? So, for instance, pharmaceutical companies will say a lot, and they seem to have a pretty strong case, that if we do not get a guaranteed return, exclusive monopoly on the return of our investment, we're not going to invest in new drugs.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are certainly goods, intellectual goods, that are produced in this world that require such an enormous upfront investment that without the promise of some protection down the road, they won't be made. They won't be made, or at least they won't be made in the amount that society deems sort of optimal. Pharmaceuticals may be among those. I mean, I sort of, in the abstract at least, I buy that argument, that without some form of patent protection, we're not going to put $200 million into finding a new drug. I don't think the vast majority of creative works on the copyright side, I don't think that's true for. I think that's what we now see.
I mean, there are obviously other ways that one can make money.
And there are other ways.
I mean, drugs obviously is very different. But if you're a musician, for instance, and your record leaks, it's not the end of the world. You have touring, you have merchandising, and things like that.
I mean, one of the things that's fascinating about intellectual property in general is that the abstract theories make a huge amount of sense. But when you look at specific examples, oftentimes that model just doesn't really explain behavior.
And the nice Jeffersonian hook in all this is that, I mean, Jefferson is sort of the father of the idea that the only reason we have intellectual property is to incentivize people. And if it's not incentivizing people, we should get rid of it. It's not a natural right. It's not a moral right. I mean, many European systems actually have a very different view about it. But kind of our view is a Jeffersonian one, that if copyright's not providing an incentive anymore, then it's just a drag on the system.
And do you find that it's trending in a different direction now? Nick mentioned Pirate Bay, which is the big Swedish BitTorrent website, which is named Pirate Bay. It's actually a reaction to the Swedish government agency, the Anti-Pirate Bureau.
Right.
And they now, as of...
Which has got to sound better in Swedish.
Yeah. No, actually it sounds worse. Anti-Pirate Bureau. Yeah. As of 2 days ago, there is a new law in Sweden, and they've seen internet traffic, actual physical traffic through the pipes of the internet, drop enormously, because there is now a law in Sweden that if you are trading, if somebody petitions, they can get your information from an internet service provider. Right. I mean, do you see that, like, there is a trend in that direction?
I mean, there's a trend, there's sort of a bimodal trend, in a sense. There is a trend towards strengthening intellectual property. In the face of this onslaught, the content providers are...
It's taken a long time, though, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, it depends what you mean by long. It's the other thing about if you're working on 18th century stuff, you don't think long.
Yeah,
I mean, it's 10 years.
It's kind of fascinating, because when you're still talking about cyberspace as the new world,
right.
And it's funny because, like, on another level, people are like,
we've been there, done that. Right.
Yeah.
So, well, I mean,
you're right. I mean, in the same way that the analogy to the new world was still very new in 1800
or 1900, or in 1780. Yeah. I mean, they've been there for 150 years.
Right,
I mean, they've been settled, and not to mention the Native Americans, obviously, but the Europeans had been there for 150 years. So new is all about what you think it is. That's part of the message, in a sense. I want people to at least consider the possibility that it's still the potential is still there. It's still an unexplored place, if you will. I mean, I think there's been a hardening of intellectual property on the one hand, and a sort of a clamping down. At the same time, that these sort of the more you do that, the more the pirates sort of come out of the woodwork, in a sense. I mean, you have a tremendous increase, you know, since Napster and all that.
Yeah.
The amount of peer-to-peer traffic has just been going up, has continued to go up exponentially with new tools. They'll move out of Sweden. Mm-hmm. If need be. I mean, that's part of what's going on, is it's very difficult for any one set of laws to actually get control over activity on the net.
Pete, how does the work on pirates or looking at them as kind of self-regulating entities, how does that affect, the news? And you have spoken and written a lot about the financial crisis and economic issues today. Mm-hmm. How does your work intersect with that? And, I think the most common thing is that people say, well, Wall Street are a bunch of pirates, they're buccaneers, they're privateers, they're profiteers, et cetera. Does your work speak to that in a particular way?
I think it does a little bit. I mean, the first thing that I would want to point out is, even though I'm happy to always draw comparisons between pirates and basically anything.
Sure.
The Wall Street comparison is very much mistaken in many ways. 18th century pirates, even though I love them in many ways, they were not wealth producers. They were siphoning off existing wealth for themselves. Wall Street pirates are in the act of productive activities that make the world a better place. They can make mistakes that, of course, large mistakes in some instances, and I don't necessarily think that there's reason to think that that's the cause for the crisis, but in any event, even if you accept that, the fact is that on average, they've increased the amount of wealth available to us tremendously, and so we shouldn't forget that. But in terms of lessons that 18th century pirates lessons that they have that could be applied to Wall Street, for instance, I think one of the actual things which is important for thinking about how we're going to respond to the crisis at the moment is actually the benefits and the effectiveness of self-regulation. Yeah. And we're trending and talking about now in the political sphere moving in exactly the opposite direction.
Self-regulation
is not popular at all, right?
It's
because,
not.
I mean, in a lot of ways, Wall Street bad behavior and economic bad behavior is seen as a failure to self-regulate, both at the consumer level, we take on too much debt, we can't help ourselves, and then at the sector level.
Right.
But so what's the self-regulation that needs to happen needs to be empowered?
The thing is that even the best self-regulation won't be effective if you have an external entity, for example, government, paying people to behave in ways that are completely at odds with that, which is exactly what I think we have in the case of the current crisis.
Can you put some meat on those bones?
Yeah, sure. So, for example, if you are subsidizing or implicitly subsidizing Fannie and Freddie, right, or banks to make loans that ultimately are being loans made to people who shouldn't be in those homes, unprofitable loans, those banks, risky loans, banks are going to take on that additional risk. And it doesn't matter. I mean, the thing to think about is what would have happened in a world in which government weren't subsidizing that kind of behavior? What kind of self-regulations would have emerged to, for example, control the derivative creation process, and so on? And we're never going to have the answer to that. But I think, as a starting point, rather than hammering on the idea of markets not functioning or hammering on the idea of self-regulation, which is, I think, what's largely happened, we should think about how it is that government actually encouraged the behavior in the first place. Going back to the main point again, which I know I'm harping on, but people are economic actors. If you pay them to do something, pay them more, they're going to engage in more of that behavior. And, it doesn't matter what kind of roadblocks you try to introduce after the fact. Conditional on the fact that it's profitable for them to do that, they'll do it, whether it's economically destructive or economically productive.
Yes.
Yeah, this whole, I often wonder when I hear the discussion about self-regulation, sort of what's the opposite of self-regulation is what exactly? Sort of a regulation by others. It's harder to justify when you think about it that way. But what's interesting to me about the net is an example of, Tom Friedman had something in the Times when the crisis broke, financial crisis broke. He said, we have new, it's sort of a whole new world out there. Everything is connected and nobody's in charge.
Sounds horrifying.
No, it sounds horrifying. It sounds like,
sounds pretty damn good to me.
It
sounds like the internet is what it sounds like. And the internet, I think, even apart from sort of the behavioral regulation on the net, which is a difficult subject and a complicated one, the net itself as a project, as an engineering project, was built with nobody in charge.
Right.
And everything is connected. And it seems to work quite well. I mean, they devised a sort of a governance scheme on the technical side. It's an international engineering project. Again, in 1980, you would have said, it can't be done. You can't build the great global network with this loose collection of committees and
people, ragtag bunch,
ragtag bunch of misfit engineers who would get together on email and rule by consensus.
Are you talking about the Dirty Dozen, by the way? Is that the intro to the Dirty Dozen?
Is that what we're talking about?
You couldn't have done it. So I think, I mean, to me, there's a, I don't know what the lesson is, but I think there's a lesson there for the global financial institutions in a way of that's a self-regulatory system that has managed to build something that nobody else really could have imagined building, and worth taking a look at sort of how did they do that exactly and what lessons can we take from that.
And we're going to end it there. Nick Gillespie for the Reason TV Talk Show, a freewheeling discussion of politics, culture, and ideas. My co-host is Michael C. Moynihan. And our guests today were Pete Leeson of George Mason University and the author of The Invisible Hook, The Hidden Economics of Pirates, and Temple University's David Post, the author of Jefferson's Moose, Notes on the State of Cyberspace. Thanks.